Okay, this is session 8, side 2 of the first cassette for July 10th, 2006. And we just finished saying on the other side about the ridiculous image of the cyborg, yet it's popular. And then you were saying what? That it's...
Well, I said, I don't know if it's fair to call it a ridiculous image. It's an image. And it's, but what people don't get is it's a metaphor for what happened to them inside, and in, you know, in, internally, their perceptual. They've become cyborgs, but not in the literal sense that they're half machine, half hardware, half biology.
Right. It is. Why the image is ridiculous is it does not include the TV body and the coming chip body, which are totally different landscapes, new organs that are attached and swallow up the chemical body. The chemical body has two legs, two arms, two eyes, and that. The TV body doesn't have that. And so the image of the cyborg is the impregnation of something from the chip body level or the TV body level back into the chemical body, and so you have a cyborg. But that's just the effect of the TV and the chip body on the chemical body, but it is not an image of the TV body. Now, you can't see the TV body, you can't image it, so how can you register it? Well, this is what you do. You look at what the fads are, at what, it's like advertising, you look at what people are becoming fascinated by, what suddenly becomes popular, what happens in politics, what kind of leader image is necessary, what kind of music is popular, what kind of sports figures, what kind of sport. What kind of war takes place? What's happening in the schools and universities? What's happening to the kind of drug that corporate employees got to take, you know, for like Valium? Or what kind of medication? What kind of hospitals? So you take an inventory across the society, and you see something's rippling, and you look for the common denominator of all those changes, if it's possible. And you see that is the registration of the TV body. Then when the chip body comes in, you start looking at what happens to the TV body's inventory and how it changes. And on a simple level, we know the TV has changed over the last 10 years. What is the main icon? Reality TV. That's a big paradigm shift in the TV industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we know that that reflects something needed by the chip body, which has caused the change in the TV content and registered the change on the TV body, which then registers on the chemical body. So that's the beginning of how you look at what the TV body is, because the TV body is us all inside a dangling extension of the ganglia of the central nervous system called television. You could see that taking psychedelics in the 60s was the beginning of registering the imagery of psychedelics is an approximation of the imagery that's happening to millions of people inside the TV body landscape. You see what I'm saying? The imagery. Look at this whole psychedelic phase.
Has the, what's the word for when one sensory input is merged or translates into another sensory input? Synesthesia. The psychedelic has the synesthetic effect.
Yes, yeah. The TV body is largely fractalized, synesthesia. And all of a sudden, from 65 to 70, you have the population, usually it's registered in the younger people first, and the affluent kids. But the changes in the music industry from Sam Cooke to Jimi Hendrix in a few years, just one level. And the population in the early 60s belonging to frats and drinking to, you know, drugged out LSD and marijuana consumers a few years later, that is an announcement of a sensory need and a sensory satisfaction evoked by some kind of new invisible landscape. And the landscape is the effect of television inside the new satellite environment. And so the imagery in pop culture in the arts is generally seen as psychedelic, and the music becomes incredibly loud. Now, young kids, they responded and needed, and they merged with it, and they didn't find it too painful, though some did. There were battles within the sensory preferences. It was like hippies versus straights. But look at the older generation, people in their 50s, 60s, in the 1960s, just thought there was total disgusting noise happening.
Yeah. I can, from my personal experience, I can say that I was stuck in between the two worlds because I was still relating to and loyal to the reality of my mom and dad's world.
Yeah.
And I was relating to and becoming loyal to this new pop culture psychedelic reality, and it created tremendous conflict because those two realities didn't fit well together.
Yeah, and I think that conflict happened in every family in North America and in Europe. And what it is that you were loyal to your chemical body landscape, which is your family, but you had the drawing and the seduction of a TV body being added onto you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the conflict. So the conflict was common. What you had, everybody had. And in particular, you then take an individual and track them. You know, what happened to a kid who ends up with Andy Warhol, or a kid who ends up in a cult, or a kid who was a DJ in New York City? All these people had unique little life variations on this, and they would go into one extreme or the other, and they would have all kinds of interesting idiosyncratic fates. But the common denominator across the thing was that they all were dealing with the conflict with their nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
And the conflict between the chemical body and the new TV body. So you have many kids who died taking LSD in the 60s. You had others forming communes, others who went into math and physics and formed new models. You know, the Stuart Brands and those people went into Whole Earth Catalog, and then that goes into Silicon Valley, and the computer world that led into Gates and Steve Jobs and those guys. They were trying to translate some of their psychedelic experiences into chip body or computerized landscapes. So anyways, we're talking locally. I mean, there's all kinds of effects. Take the riot in Mexico when the students were killed. The student riot in the year the Olympics were in Mexico in 68. They had a student revolution down there, and thousands were murdered. Wasn't covered on the international news so much, but there's a problem right there. The chemical bodies of Mexican students conflicting with the chemical bodies of their seniors under the impact of at least television and probably the satellite, though very subconscious. Then you had that disruption in Europe and in China. So, you know, it's just, you just go read a newspaper, grab a newspaper from that period for several days, and it scans the whole globe for you. You'll see chaos is an understatement. So it's like McLuhan said Wyndham Lewis wrote in his book, The Childer Mass, 1928, was about the massacre of, and yeah, 1928, this is after World War One. We're into the 20s, and he's talking about the massacre of the children, the massacre of innocent populations under movie, newspapers, and radio. He was the first to deal with these media environments as a writer, as a novelist. But it's a childer mass.
Psychological massacre?
No, physical. Well, there was a Great War was one of the effects. Then there was the Depression of the early 20s. That was when Germany, you know, they had to have wheelbarrows of cash to buy half a loaf of bread in 1923 and 24. That was just the effect of the economy in Germany. There was all kinds of
battles. I'd like to interject. I don't think it's fair to say that that the new media forms, radio, newspaper, television, they were a catalyst, but it was an equation between two variables. The other variable was that you did have human beings throughout the world in their own cultures and their subcultures and their own territorial needs. And what it did was it put everybody in everybody else's face.
Yes.
So that their natural tendency to for private property and to maintain their private cultural image of themselves.
Or tribal culture if they're in non-industrialized societies.
Yeah. So it was these two factors which caused the problems. I mean, if human beings weren't territorial and new media came along and put everybody in everybody else's space, then we would have figured out how to work it out so that we could all live together.
It's
but because of human greed and solipsistic personal needs and personal identity and personal wealth, that's what generated the conflict when the media started melting everybody into everybody else, and then everybody was trying to maintain their own ground, and so they started fighting with each other.
Right. Okay, now look what you're saying. To maintain their own ground is previous media development. Don't think that media just means 20th century electric media. Media is a rice paddy. It's a society built around the rice paddy. It's mines in England. Okay, there's these media structures. And when you bring new media, they automatically upset the older media structures, just like when you take some new intense effect on your senses, it upsets the equilibrium of your own sensory profile before you took the new sensory disturbance. So look at media as miming the disruption of your senses by when you go into a freezing room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Your sensory equilibrium is upset, especially if you come from a hot environment. Now, this is why McLuhan uses the hot and cold. When you take new electric media and throw them into any culture, now when we talk about culture, a culture is a collection of previous media. And they are upset. And the expression of that is an identity crisis.
Where does the previous media live? In the chemical body nervous system of the human beings who live within that media culture. So there's a direct relationship between the DNA mental programming or perceptual programming of the human being is what's being upset, causing panic within the chemical body or the human population.
Yeah, chemical body is our five senses.
Yeah, so it's really bringing, in a sense, it's bringing, you know, it's an interplay between new media
and old media
and first nature. I mean, it's natural.
No, first nature is another level. We're talking about different stages.
First nature is the chemical body. It's the raw need to eat, to feel secure, to have shelter, to maintain a sense of personal identity.
Right, but remember, when I use the term chemical body, that is the term that I use for what you call first nature, but it is a second nature model that got dominance through Western industrial complex in the 19th century.
Sure.
So we're
I'm
not saying that our physical body is a chemical body. It's just that is the model
right. That
second nature imposes on it. First nature is something that we aren't fully aware of or fully cognizant of all that happens in it.
Yeah, but we know that human beings can become upset. When they're uncomfortable, they can become aggressive, territorial, angry, frightened, paranoid.
When you say territorial, they want to preserve whatever media they have.
Right. So I think you got to also remember that there are human beings at the center of these media environments that are the media. We can see how the media environments, new media environments, are upsetting old media environments. But those old media environments live inside of the brains of human beings who are becoming upset, and the way that they react biologically, psychologically, unconsciously, is where the problem arises.
Right. Well, I wouldn't use the terms biological, psychological. Those are Western terms. So what do people have in common? It's senses. So that's why McLuhan used sensory profiles. You bring in
when you talk about the five senses, we're talking about neutral input neutral sensory input coming in from the environment. But human beings have psychological dispositions. And they have the need to maintain state and to maintain
their
family and their survival. It comes down to the survival of the human being is threatened in relation to their perception of their...
Yes, but here's the problem. They react to these new threats and think they're preserving themselves, and they cause even worse trouble. So there's another factor, that they are not preserving themselves in a sensible way, and the reason is that because you got these general sensory profiles across the culture. Of course, there's individual perversities and extremisms or blandness and individual personalities, but we're talking about big, broad patterns here. So you use the sensory characteristics and then the media extensions. So let's look at when the American Admiral went to Japan in 1853. I think it was 1853. Here's this industrial culture confronting this feudal culture, and there was all kinds of strange effects. And the Japanese invented new maneuvers to deal with that, and we don't need to go into the historical inventory of the particulars. But any encounter, which is what McLuhan called the dangerous liaisons, hybrid energy invests a weird transmutation and conflict and breakthroughs when one weird sensory cultural media profile meets another. That's the normal interaction. And so the culture preserves its past while being changed by the new, and leads to all kinds of banana skin pirouettes and collapses,
right,
and unforeseen breakthroughs. So,
because you have a bunch of human beings who are scared, panicking, they don't know how to cope with, they don't understand the unconscious forces acting on them, so they're like lemmings running off a cliff.
And that's always what happens. Now, so the 20th century was the first time, McLuhan proffered, that we could see this process. We could see what caused the panic and the identity crisis. This is the first time enough speed up happened, enough transformations and cultural clash, that we could begin to see the causes. And the causes were new inventions.
Right.
Not necessarily greed or all the traditional seven sins. Those were constant. But since massive communities were in touch with each other through the electric photo replays, then there's a new dimension here that allowed us to have a new insight on the changes and explanations for traditional banana skin pirouettes and collapses.
Mm-hmm.
So to talk about human greed or human ego, yes, it's always there. But when you got many cultures and their sensory profile biases interacting with everybody else inside new electric media, which creates a discarnate body, then the appeal to human decency, as McLuhan says in his review of William Burroughs, there's no obscenity, no decency, and no pornography in the electric situation when men are eating each other and digesting each other. And that's what happens when we're inside the electronic vortex. Cultures and media are consuming each other.
Isn't that process sort of obscene in and of itself?
If you don't understand it, it would seem obscene, and it could be considered obscene if you understood it. But how you modulate it was the problem McLuhan had. Now, how do you recommend a society to deal with it? He said, well, basically, turn off television. You start to disconnect for a few months. In other words, you couldn't have new legislation or new welfare programs, new educational content, new ballet, new operas, new movies. None of that will keep up with the effects. So what you do, the problem is the electronic vortex, so you turn it off if you could.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way you'd solve it. So the solution is in the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is a simple environment, then you turn it off.
And unfortunately, the problem seems inevitable. I mean, unfortunately, the problem's inevitable. I mean, there was only one McLuhan and 4 billion people, and
there's no way that it was going to be turned off. What's interesting, though, is that he ends up writing books that gives people an image, a mental paradigm that they can say, oh, this kind of explains things. And I always like to cite the example of the big agony of the concentration camp victims as they're being killed. The big problem, the big anxiety inside them was they didn't know why it was happening. They wanted to know why. It's just natural for human beings to understand, to sort of have a handle on why things are happening, even though it's pretty terrible.
Well, you're talking about the Jewish concentration camps,
yeah.
The Holocaust?
Yeah.
Well, but that bias against the Jewish gene pool, you know, we can trace that back thousands of years.
Do you know why that happened in the 30s? It wasn't due to you could say it wasn't due to racism or anti-Semitism.
Well, the popular notion is that the Jews had been discriminated against for so long that they had to figure out how to survive, and in figuring out how to survive, they became better at doing certain kinds of economic maneuvers, and that caused them to become even a greater threat. And so then they were used as scapegoats as to why. The economy was failing, and if we get rid of them, it's their fault. We get rid of them, we can get back on track.
That's right. If you, just as McLuhan said, if you put Hitler on a TV environment, you wouldn't have had a Nazi Germany. But Hitler's image worked well in a radio environment. If you didn't have radio, you wouldn't have had the Holocaust. Because first of all, the Holocaust creates a discarnate effect. It moves you out of biology, making biology expendable, and that brought in the eugenics idea. So you had certain elites responding to the discount effect of radio, and one of them was the claustrophobia that radio created in Europe. And so the German population, which was feeling an inferiority complex after losing World War One, gradually had to find a scapegoat under the imploded reality of radio, and they picked the Jews as a scapegoat. And on the surface, you know, it's because they're anti-Semitic or because they were businessmen, blah, blah, blah. But if you didn't have the radio environment, you wouldn't have had the intensity of the, quote, final solution.
Yeah.
So you have to look at the...
So it intensified. It didn't... It retrieved eugenics. It didn't create it. I mean, eugenics, the idea of eugenics had been going along all along, but it intensified.
Well, how long? Eugenics wasn't possible until Mendeleev invented the gene. You know, in the 1900s.
Invented what?
The gene.
The gene.
Yeah, the idea that you could breed plants. You know, the monk who discovered genetics. Mendeleev, I think his name is.
I always think of Darwin because, he's a popular icon.
Mendeleev comes after Darwin. But the point is that eugenics became a popular movement in the 20s and 30s, and people are shocked. Where there's a guy who did a book a few years ago. I went to his talk. I forget his name. His name might be Black. He also did a book on IBM working with the Nazis in the concentration camps using their early computers. But he did a book on the eugenics movement and how these, very respectable people in society really thought that you should prune out dumb people, inferior minorities, and all that stuff. They actually believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that is an effect of the post-biological model that radio brought in, radio, telephone, movies, and the chemical body became a programmable entity. And you had this early enthusiasm to do that. And the radio is an important factor in that. See, we're trying to point out the causes of people's social realities. And people could argue over this idea or that idea, but we're using, with McLuhan, the sensory facts. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand that media hints those sensory facts, then you can have something that's a common perception of the causes of conflict and pleasures and services and disservices. You can have this as something that people can see immediately through cognition rather than relying on abstract notions of anti-Semitism or racism or class structure and those things. Those notions are products of the 19th century. I mean, the British imperialism that created the idea of race, in the 1800s, 1700s, and that was because they were under the impact of the Gutenberg and early newspaper medium, which enhanced the eye, which enhanced discrimination. Now, when you say this kind of sentence, people say, oh, the book doesn't enhance my eye. We're not talking about the physiological effect on you. We're talking about the effect on a society and its general memes or the effects of previous media, which create collective assumptions. And the new media upsets those collective assumptions. It's a very strange process that goes on, and we're just beginning to get a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the meme is an attempt to get an understanding on how culture works on a general ESP level among humans in a particular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring in a new culture or new media, then that upsets the ESP that was formed around the previous media.
Yeah. So when you say ESP, you don't mean brain-to-brain telegraphing of thoughts. You're just talking about everybody soaking within a social context, which
includes the soaking in his thoughts. I'm talking brain-to-brain and any other ways you want to talk about it. And the fact that you can understand me when I speak English is an example of ESP. There's something that I'm doing.
It's not the way that parapsychologists think of ESP.
Well, they're just a specialist. Do they have a lock on the concept? If you want to believe in the specialist monopoly, yeah, they have a lock on the concept, but I'm not staying limited to that. I can use different ways to perceive the notion of ESP. Matter of fact,
you're mutating the popular concept, because if we were operating under the popular concept of ESP, you and I would not be making small mouth noises to talk to each other. We'd just be projecting into one another's brains.
It wouldn't be verbal.
Right.
Well, while we're talking, there is the verbal, but we're also projecting other levels of intonation and thought that accompanies our words.
Yeah.
There's things you're thinking about what I'm saying to you, as well as what the obvious meaning of the words are.
Yeah, but that's private to me, and you don't know what I'm thinking until I respond, and then even then you only have a vague sense of what
I'm
thinking.
I react on that. You see, I may never reach an other mind, but I interpret there is another mind, and I react to that, and I react to the reactions that other mind has to my reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the drama of cognition. So the particular scientific Gutenberg definition of ESP is what we call dialectical, and simplifies it to one meaning, which is not completely useful, not totally useful for understanding human communication, which is always multi-leveled,
mm-hmm.
multi-gestural. So it's a complex thing, and any particular issue never gets resolved, never gets defined. Science is always saying we need to do more research.
Yeah.
We see this, we see that, need more research. As long as you're trying to match exactly, it never will be totally successful.
Just once again, ESP, extrasensory perception, that's parasensory information or data exchange. And when we're talking about ESP within the context of media environments, we're talking about information coming in directly through the senses. Now, that information may be distributed collectively, creating a matrix, which causes everyone to sort of perceive the same thing. And in that sense, it could be a metaphor for ESP, but I don't think it's really ESP.
Well, are you limiting your understanding of ESP?
To the popular notion of what ESP is,
no, we
yeah.
call it popular.
Well, okay, no, just literally, extrasensory perception. I mean,
what
like
do you call this? The telephone. This is extrasensory perception. I'm able to communicate to you 3,000 miles away with this apparatus.
Yeah, but data's still coming in through my ear nerve. It's not direct data transfer from your mind to my mind. The data's being massaged through the telephone lines and then recreated, and then it comes in through my ear nerve. So it comes in through my sensory organ of perception. And I don't call that extra sensory or para or metaphysical or metasensory.
Well, that's what we're talking about, extra chemical body. I mean, if you can have a definition of what you mean by ESP, and you would.
I think the definition is embedded in what ESP means, extra sensory.
Right, but it refers to something that we don't know if anybody has experienced. It may be expressed differently in different cultures, and cultures say, yes, that's ESP and this isn't, and other cultures say, well, no, that's not ESP, this is ESP. So the definitions are never stabilized. They were stabilized in the print era from 1500 on with just the book as the medium. You had the standardization of the dictionary and what's called the dialectical tradition took over from the rhetorical grammatical tradition in Western educations, because you could now begin to get a second look at things and get particular. And so mathematics came in as a popular means to the Newtonian mathematics took over from previous forms of communication, which were largely philosophical, poetic, and theatrical. So it dominated. But when you get into Einstein in the 20th century with new media, the precision becomes weak. And you have new instruments to make things more precise, but you're up against the effect of the diffusion of the focus on the eye into the other senses, which are retrieved, and then that creates the suggestibility of other meanings, and then that causes all kinds of fragmentation of the Gutenberg era. So if you ignore those effects on the pursuit of what something means, what's the exact definition, you're going to end up being pretty ineffective. So that's the service of new media. They break up the assumptions and rigidity, what we call imagination. And imagine a person, when they try to do experiments to establish ESP, they got to be imaginative and have a detached view of what it is to invent an interesting laboratory experiment. So you have to be careful.
The experiments usually involve putting people in Faraday cages so there can be no measurable electromagnetic energy going from one person to the other, so that they can see if there's some kind of subtle energy that we don't understand that could be directly transferred from brain to brain without actually going through any of the five or six sensory organs.
Right, and that's an assumption that ESP happens that way. ESP may be caused by angels coming in between people and oozing one thing into another person. We don't know, ultimately. What are the consequences?
Now when we're talking about verbal speech, you're mechanically creating noises, which I'm mechanically hearing with my sensory organs and interpreting in the way that I've been culturally learned to interpret
yes,
those
but,
noises.
Yes, but when a scientist sets up a lab to measure ESP as an hypothesis of what it is and tries to prove it or disprove it, he is working with a model that may not be. In the end, in 1,000 years, when we actually find out what ESP is, if we have a particular meaning for it, mind-to-mind transfer, it may not be at all what people thought it could be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm using the metaphor like it could be an angel. It could be when cockroaches are around, and suddenly cockroaches have some effect on human beings, and they make human beings more sensitive to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's all kinds of variables that we always, in a culture, limit the variables. That's what a culture is. You specialize.
I was just visiting my friend in Grass Valley, who's a gardener, and he was saying that he's learning to become a shaman. And he says when he's working with certain plants, and there are certain types of bugs which might threaten those plants, that he's intuitively aware when the bugs start showing up, and he just goes and then he looks at the plant, and there the bugs are. So he's in some kind of extra sensory communication with his garden and the nature spirits or devas or whatever you want to call it.
Well, it may not be extra sensory. It may be just a focusing on that project, and then certain things are evoked as effects of it. Mm-hmm. Certain pattern recognition. What's the medium he's operating in? What are all the media that he's operating in doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Basically, he's got his chemical body, and does he do anything else? What other cultural implements does he use?
Define cultural implements.
Anything that humans make.
Well,
he uses
a pencil in his daily life, but in the garden he uses a hoe, he uses fertilizers, he uses seeds and stuff like that.
Right, so those fertilizers, what are they made of?
Just chemicals, yeah.
Right, so he observes, why does he call that shamanism? By observing things.
Well, I'm saying that I think he's becoming a shaman because he seems to be attuned. This is not a small garden. This is almost like a farm. And he feels that he's becoming attuned to the plants and animals within that environment such that he knows where to look for a problem because he intuits it before he sees it.
Well, you look at any anthropologists, when they study native cultures all around the world, they're amazed at their sensitivities to the media they're operating in. And we would call those media first nature, probably,
mm-hmm.
since they have a small amount of human artifact. They've got food-making things, clothing, hats, whatever, pretty primitive compared to us, but they're also interacting with first nature, and they develop patterns. So it's like an Eskimo who sees 50 kinds of snow. It's just like a kid watching TV. They know how to look at a program and look at it for 3 seconds, say, oh, I know where that program's going, I'm not going to go there, and they go somewhere else. So they're grazing among the technological animals and insects when they're watching television. And the sensitivities and rapidity they have, for someone who doesn't know it, they think that was pretty shamanistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's something that might come closer worth exploring within the context of this discussion about what is speech and what is ESP. My housemate says she has a dog who's getting on in years, who she has a very close relationship to. And she tells me that her dog understands her. Almost everything that she says to the dog, she believes the dog understands. Now, I don't know how much imagination is coming into play or whether or not the dog really does understand her, but let me assume for a moment that the dog does understand her. Well, I don't believe for one moment that the dog understands English, but somehow it's translating the intent between her word, the intent within her words, and somehow translating that into its own understanding.
Yeah.
But still,
we could call that ESP.
I suppose we could, but then also there's still the concrete material sound waves emanating from her mouth and transmitting to the dog's ears. So there's some material frequency there that's, you know, it's going from mouth.
You're thinking ESP involves non-material.
Yeah, or energies that are too subtle to be measured as material within our
model.
Models.
Which is a limited model, but the media that the cultures use over the last 150 years determines the limitations of that model. You know what I mean? The
mm-hmm.
media determines it. Now, what we got here is, I remember Alan Watts used to say that he took LSD to turn microscopes onto his inner processes and his body and maybe psychological processes, and he said he considered he was still exploring nature, still finding out what nature is. Well, we don't know what nature is or what's all that's communicating. So McLuhan said, well, let's look at these artifacts and see how they're communicating with humans.
Cool.
And so he made an inventory of effects. And just as when your housemate is interacting with a dog, we don't know fully what's going on. And why limit it to material or immaterial? We just haven't got ways to make it translate back into visible meters or something. But it doesn't stop the process going on. And what would happen if there was no radio or TV in your home? What would happen to the relationship between your housemate and the dog if there was a different environment? Maybe if they were in an igloo, you know? So the material environment around communicates something that is part of the communication between the woman and the dog. And we're always trying to get a handle on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
in fact,
she leaves the TV on for the dog when she leaves because she thinks that the dog gets freaked when it feels alone, but it doesn't feel so alone when the TV's making noise.
So there she's using it as a substitute, and we learn how to use media. And now if you have a million people doing that in a society with their dogs, because they have television, what is being communicated within all that among all the humans? So we're looking at what is being communicated other than what is apparently being communicated. And so the effect of radio in Germany, what was communicated, led to 6 million people being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And no one foresaw that the communication matrix would be changed to lead to that kind of, communication. I mean,
well, it provided the instrument for that to happen because, for instance, the content was determined by the brain of Hitler and his administration. He's the one who singled out the Jews. He could have singled out some other population and used them. He could have constructed the content differently. It was his choices that created that. Let's go after the how we're going to use the intensity of this new media.
Right.
The media itself didn't predict that 6 million Jews were going to be killed. It
and
just provided.
Hitler predicted. Here's where you get to the usefulness here, is that it's not just the medium and it's not just the human, it's the interaction. The interaction that creates the effects and the message. And so Hitler could not do what he had done unless there was a group meme or group response. No one can lead a bunch of people unless you put on something they recognize.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's a matching there. And so it's a subtle interplay between an individual's will and the accumulated cultural response to that will and what they recognize in it that's in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You there?
Yes.
Yeah. There was a weird distortion happened there. Anyway, so the let's go on to, with all that we've said, I want to reread the quote. Let's go on to the next quote.
Yes.
Leasing our eyes and ears and nerves to commercial interests. Interesting, he says leasing. That means just renting, right?
Mm-hmm.
It may not. If we had mediacology, we would stop that maybe. I mean, what McLuhan said that, you know, Lenin and Stalin was a medieval retrieval of Russian culture under the impact of early electric media. And they wanted to stop the world, and so they became media ecologists in the sense they wouldn't allow any Western cultural products into the Soviet Union, you know, from the 20s on, as much as possible. They tried to stop the world.
Yeah.
And so they stopped the leasing of eyes and ears and nerves to commercial interests, mm-hmm. to Western capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They tried to control it.
Yeah.
So leasing our eyes and ears and nerves to commercial interests is like handing over the common speech to a private corporation or like giving the Earth's atmosphere to a company as a monopoly. So McLuhan's playing there with what is the boundaries of speech? How could you, have a private corporation charge what words you could use? It's an absurd image, but he's trying to make a percept of the fact that new media are common speech. It's only the Western Gutenberg idea of private property that's imposed on the common tribalism. So it's like giving the Earth's atmosphere to a company as a monopoly. Something like this has already happened with outer space for the same reasons that we have leased our central nervous systems to various corporations. Okay, so he has here, leasing our eyes and ears and nerves to commercial interests. And then he now says our central nervous system. So the first phase is about our external senses, eyes and ears, but then the nerves to commercial interests. But then he kind of fine-tunes it to we've leased our central nervous systems to various corporations. As long as we adopt the narcissist attitude, and narcissist was a mythical character who was hypnotized by his own image. That's how McLuhan interprets narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
He had no imagination. He was embedded in the image.
And it was an extension of himself.
Yeah,
it was not himself. It was not really. It was not. It was not who he was. It was an extension of himself that wasn't actually who he was.
Yeah, and then
and then he fell in love with it
because he thought it was something else. This is what's interesting.
He fell in love with an image of himself.
Yes, and he fell in love with it because he thought it was not him.
Oh, he thought it was somebody else.
Yeah, we project back, he's looking at himself, and of course he recognizes himself, and he's a narcissist, he's in love with his own image. But McLuhan shifts that a little bit, says, no, he did not know it was himself, it wasn't a vanity thing. He loved the image. He loved the image because he thought it was something else, and his girlfriend, Echo, was pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wasn't loving her anymore. As long as we adopt the narcissist attitude of regarding the extensions of our own bodies as really out there. See, that's what he did. He thought an extension of himself was out. He thought a part of himself, he did not recognize it was out there. He thought it was something else.
He thought it was somebody else.
Yeah, something else. And didn't recognize it was him. And McLuhan says, we don't recognize that media are ourselves. We think they're something else.
Mm.
We think they're alien technologies. We think they're not us.
Yeah.
So the particular meaning of the narcissist myth by McLuhan, which is you do not recognize it is you.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not recognize that media are extensions of your nerves and your own eyes, then you're a narcissist because you think they're something else, not an extension of you, not you. You see
sure.
what I'm saying?
Yeah. Whereas with hardware, like a tractor, you look at that and you're pretty clear that that's not you. With the software, it becomes, if it's an extension of you, it may in fact be you in some way.
Good point here. Mechanical media, like the bulldozer, definitely don't look like us. But the point, McLuhan's point is they are us. But electric media are more organic or more human-like. Excuse me. Something in my mouth. They're more like speech. They're more, the electric media are organic and not mechanical. because they make us think they're us. Now, the idea that media are us has to be applied to two different situations here. The mechanical thing is, no, that's not me. But the fact that I could hear someone on a radio, and it's a human being communicating to me, like ESP almost, then I think media are us.
If you didn't project yourself into the content, you wouldn't stay interested and you'd tune on to something else. So you're projecting yourself into the content.
Well, if you're following me here, the idea that the medium is an extension of us is a natural idea in the electric age, because electric media are more human-friendly, not like a bulldozer, and we do think they are us.
Yeah.
There's an interesting distinction semantically about the aphorism, the medium is a message, that the idea of the medium is a message, McCone said, is a popular idea in the electric age. The idea that media are extensions of us is amenable to the sensibility in electric media, and we should not get hypnotized by the idea that media are an extension of us. This is a subtlety that not many people get about McLuhan, because he's trying to get you to detach from what's happening. And if you think they're extensions of us, you're going to be like...
It's pretty damn hard to detach when media, which are extensions of your senses, operate in a closed loop.
Right. The electric age is maybe more like a closed loop. So your idea of organicity is expressed by the phrase closed loop.
Mm-hmm.
Closed loop is organic to you.
Well, I'm not sure what you're saying.
Yeah, probably. You probably mean a closed loop was like claustrophobic. But
no, I mean that it's a it's cybernetic.
The feedback loop.
It's a feedback loop.
Yeah, it's responding to you, and you're responding to it.
Yeah, and so